This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. 19th century writer Charles Chestnut was once the most popular African-American author of his time. But everything changed after his 1901 novel, The Marrow of Tradition. It was a fictionalized account of the 1898 coup d'etat in Wilmington. Many critics reviewed the book, and most of them panned it. One famous reviewer called it a bitter book. It ruined Chestnut's career. Today, critics look at that novel much differently. And North Carolina author Wiley Cash says the more than 100-year-old story is still very meaningful today. Wiley Cash is what writer in residence at the University of North Carolina at Asheville. He wrote the introduction to the latest publication of The Marrow of Tradition. It's out later this month. Wiley Cash, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about Charles Chestnut.
Well, Charles Chestnut's an interesting character. Born in 1858 in Cleveland, his parents were former slaves in North Carolina, and they moved up to Cleveland just before the war. And then when he was a very young man, his parents settled back in eastern North Carolina, where his grandfather and his father began a general store. So Chestnut, who was highly educated, really well-read, went to the Freeman School. He also cut his teeth on folktales. So by day, he was studying and reading and learning all the science and literature. And then in the afternoon, he would go to the store and listen to folktales and conjure tales and all of these things. So he really had this kind of bifurcated identity culturally, but also physically. He was what was known as a child of miscegenation. He was a biracial child who, in many accounts, appeared white, who could have easily passed for white had he so chosen to do so, but he chose not to, and he chose to write about the black experience in North Carolina and in Cleveland and in Washington, D.C.
He wrote about those things, and he was an extremely popular. Who was reading Charles Chestnut at the time?
Everybody. A lot of his stories, he primarily published work in the Atlantic Monthly, and one of his big cheerleaders was William Dean Howells, known as the Dean of American Literature. And so Chestnut is coming of age as a literary writer of fiction around the same time that Mark Twain is writing and Kate Chopin is writing and Paul Laurence Dunbar, who was the most successful African-American poet at the time, while they're writing these local color stories. And there's great interest in the Northeast and these centers of quote-unquote culture, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston. What's going on in the South? You know, we know there's been a great war fought over, you know, slavery in the South. But what's going on in these places? And writers like Chestnut were sending cultural dispatches from North Carolina. Kate Chopin's doing it from Louisiana. Mark Twain's doing it from Mississippi.
So he's giving us those kind of regular updates. That's the journalism part of it. And he's writing novels. And as you say, he's not backing away from writing about the black experience. He's writing very deliberately about it, and very successfully.
Yeah, what he's really should be known for broadly, and not just in terms of the academy or in that kind of setting, but he's really great at predicting trends. And so what Chestnut was able to do is he's able to talk about the white adoption of black culture. So he predicts people like Elvis Presley, in effect. So he's writing when the Uncle Remus tales are coming out, right? And he writes his conjure tales, in which a white family from the north buys an old crumbling plantation in eastern North Carolina. They find a former slave, much like Uncle Remus in these intensely racist tales. Uncle Julius, in these more empowering tales, uses his intellect and his knowledge to subvert white expectation. Whereas Uncle Remus delivers white expectation, Uncle Julius subverts white expectation and uses his intellect to overpower the will of the white landowners.
And he's writing in a time, again, this is Reconstruction. This is the time now where the former slaves and the children of those who had been enslaved are now becoming educated. Mm-hmm. They are taking on businesses. They're running their own businesses now. And really beginning to develop and flourish within a generation of emancipation. And he's in North Carolina in this time. And that means he's also here in 1898 when the white power structure smashes a coalition of white and black. Remember, Wilmington, North Carolina, the most prosperous city in the state in 1898.
Sure.
It is a majority black, and it is prosperous. It
sure
is the wealthiest city in the state. And it's because of this coalition that really wants to leave that past behind. Leave your monuments to yourself. We are moving into the future, they say. And that is blasted out of office. A coup d'etat, which was never punished, 1898 then.
Sure, it's the only successful coup d'etat in American history, where a government was overthrown, the governor was contacted, refused to send in the National Guard. This happened, as you said, in 1898, and it's the tail end of Reconstruction. Reconstruction has, in effect, failed, and all of these gains were made one generation removed from slavery. And Wilmington was a town where Reconstruction was working. It was a town that was, it was a very good place to be black in the 1890s. And we have the Fusionist Party, as you mentioned. It's poor whites and the slaves and descendants of slaves forming this party based on shared values of economic injustice. And they gained a lot of power. And the power structure decided to crush that. And how do you divide white people and black people? You talk about issues of sexuality. You talk about issues of violence. You talk about white femininity. And that's exactly what caused this violence and what gave permission for this violence to happen in 1898 in Wilmington.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about exactly what happened. And again, some of the inflammatory journalism and the lies about, which all of which ultimately led to lynching and then this most brutal violence in 1898.
Okay. So in 1897 in Georgia, a woman named Rebecca Latimer Felton gave a speech to the Agricultural Society. And she was talking about protecting white womanhood. And she said something to the effect, and I'm going to misquote her by accident, but she said something to the effect of, if it takes lynching 100 black men a day to protect white women, I say let it happen. And so this was republished as an editorial in many newspapers. Well, in Wilmington, North Carolina at this time, 1897, 1898, one of the only black daily newspapers in the state was run by a man named Alexander Manley. It was called the Daily Record. And he published a response to Rebecca Latimer Felton. He's an African American, yes. He published a response to Rebecca Latimer Felton and said, you know, in effect, if you're so concerned about white women, stop allowing them to come to our side of town. If you're so concerned with miscegenation, stop white men coming after black women. You sow the seed and you will reap the fruit in due time. And so this coalition of white supremacists, many of them former slave owners, plantation owners, many of them poor whites looking to bootstrap on white success, they use this as an excuse to destroy the press, to overthrow the democratically elected government a few days after the election, and in effect to murder as many as few as a dozen, as many as a couple of hundred African Americans in Wilmington. The full travesty and the full tragedy of 1898 has never been understood, either in terms of bodies or in terms of its financial costs, because businesses were overtaken, houses were overtaken, property was just turned over into white hands.
And lest anybody think this was just a spontaneous outburst, it was well organized and well planned by some of the wealthiest and most prestigious white men in North Carolina.
Yes, absolutely.
So there it is. That sets the scene. Now you have the successful author, Charles Chestnut, and he decides to take this on in the form of a novel that he will call The Marrow of Tradition. So talk about the novel a bit.
So The Marrow of Traditions comes out in 1901, and there are four major characters in The Marrow of Tradition. And in his nonfiction and in his journals, Chestnut writes that the South has a real mania for titles. And so in this novel, the four main male characters all have titles. There's Major Philip Carteret. He owns the white newspaper. He is the landed gentry. He is the patrician. Then there's Captain George McBain, who is actually not a captain but goes by that title. He's a former slave breaker. He's a poor white. He's probably illiterate. He's not very powerful, but he desperately wants power. And he understands that an association with Major Philip Carteret is a way to get that power. Then there's Dr. William Miller. He's Chestnut's classic kind of racial accommodationist. He's an African-American, highly educated. He's biding his time. He's improving the community. And then there's Josh Green, who has no title. He is dark-skinned, he is violent, he is powerful, he's a dock worker, he's Nat Turner, he's a revolutionary. He is the actor in this novel. He is not the waiter, as William Miller is. So those are the four main characters, and it follows much the same path that the real events of 1898 follows. That this editorial comes out of the black newspaper, the white power structure sits on it before elections, and then they decide to form a coalition and take back the city. They're going to reclaim the city for white culture, because white culture is being punished, they believe.
And so now this is a novel, a very successful novelist. He publishes it, and man, it gets panned.
It gets panned. It gets killed. William Dean Howells, who had once been Chestnut's largest supporter and probably the true benefactor of his work and of his literary success, called it a bitter, bitter book. And Chestnut didn't publish a novel again until 1907 with The Colonel's Dream, which is about convict labor, the peonage system. That was not read at all. Yep. He never published again in his lifetime.
Well, and talk about it might be pretty clear why, although if there are reasons other than simple, sort of racial shame, then you can tell me. But I wonder if the fact that you talked about Chestnut's ability to predict the future, talk about its relevance today, because he also took on the very serious themes that were essential. It wasn't just the actions that might have made your blood boil. It was the themes that really resonate today that make him seem more prescient today than he was then.
Sure. In the introduction to the new edition of Mirror of Tradition that's being put out by Belt Publishing, which is a fantastic publisher out of Cleveland, Ohio, in the introduction I write about how 1898, the race violence, the race massacre in 1898 was a solution in search of a problem. There was not this mass, there were not these raving African American men looking for white women to rape and to hurt and to attack. There were not black economic forces supplanting white economic forces. It was just capitalism at its best, yeah, at its purest, at its most pure. And of course, that wasn't tolerable. But what Chestnut saw happening was he saw that the white power structure, these patricians, the landed gentry, could convince poor whites to vote and act against their own self-interest. And he's predicting Nixon's Southern strategy. He's predicting Reagan's Southern strategy. And he's predicting, Mexico sending rapists and that it did not send.
Same kind of language, same kind of rhetoric.
The exact same kind of language. So
that does stir up a base that is actually voting against its own interest, the analyst might say.
Absolutely. And so, white supremacists marching down Front Street in Wilmington in 1898 is really no different than a presidential candidate coming down an escalator surrounded by actors he paid in a gold building that has his name on it, saying things that are not true, which is, again, an answer in search of a problem that does not exist. And we see that now. Chestnut was writing about that and publishing that in 1901.
And the way it unmasks the lie of our particular brand of capitalism. Capitalism, when it does work, really is colorblind. Capitalism, when it does work and you allow the markets to go freely without government preference and without using a military to protect your supply lines for particular corporations the way we do, it is colorblind, and sure enough, it actually worked in Wilmington. And then you see the proof of the lie, which is, oh, no, we don't mean that capitalism. We mean the one that can protect the privilege that we have as white people. We want that capitalism back. Which is not the colorblind capitalism that Wilmington proved. So does that make him, where does he stand today, Charles Chestnut? Where is he, how is he understood today?
Well, what's interesting about Chestnut is he never falls into writing that intensely didactic, he's not writing The Jungle. He's not writing this intensely didactic, social idea-driven novel. He's writing a really literary novel that's got really interesting, complex characters that are really conflicted. I mean, in every one of his novels, his black heroes are punished. They're either punished or they're shamed. Like William Miller is truly, Chestnut would have called him an accommodationist. He's highly educated. He wants to do society good. He wants to uplift the black race. But he's not as active as someone like Josh Green is. But Josh Green is not an intellectual. Josh Green is running toward the gunfire with the knife in his hand. And so Chestnut is impugning him as well. So he writes problem novels, but like a lot of social novelists, he doesn't present solutions. He just presents the problem in all its murkiness and all of its difficulty. And that feels like a wholly contemporary thing to me.
Yeah, and he threads out and he creates a trajectory that's unmistakable. Where would it go if this were all true? How did he take the criticism and what happened to his career after that?
Well, it's amazing. Chestnut had a lot of starts and stops in his life. He tried to be a reporter. He went to New York City and tried to be a reporter, and that didn't work out. probably due to racism and him identifying as black. He passed the Ohio State Bar with the highest grade in his class. Was never able to find work as an attorney due to racism, so he became a stenographer, which is a court reporter. And he finished his career as a stenographer. The NAACP awarded him the Spingarn Medal in 1928. He died in 1935. So later in his life, you know, African-American organizations were recognizing his contribution to culture and to letters and to American art. But in that time, you know, since then, he's kind of fallen away. The black arts movement is a much more intense, confrontational, you know, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker. And we're resurrecting writers Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Jean Toomer, and Chestnut because of, you know, like I said, his black heroes are killed, like Josh Green, his racial accommodationists are shamed. He never found a place in the black arts movement. He never found a clear champion. And there are champions here in North Carolina. William Andrews from UNC Chapel Hill has been a big champion of Chestnut. Sally Ann Ferguson at UNC Greensboro has been a big champion of Chestnut. And they've done a lot of work to really reposition him as an important American writer.
Well, hopefully this new edition will actually bring more attention. So thank you so much, Wiley Cash.
Thank you.
Wiley Cash is writer in residence at UNC Asheville. He wrote the introduction to the latest publication of The Marrow of Tradition by Charles Chestnut. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Wiley's going to be giving a reading and a talk Tuesday, April 16th at Bellamy Mansion Museum in Wilmington, and you can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.